Hello, and welcome to the Alcohol Problem Podcast. I'm Dr. James Morris, an alcohol researcher interested in harmful drinking and addiction issues. This stems in part from my own experiences, so the show aims to explore a range of lived and academic perspectives relating to the question of what really is an alcohol problem. In this episode, I speak to the MP John Ashworth about his experience and views of parental alcohol problems and affected others, as well as parliamentary drinking culture, the energy crisis, and other alcohol policy issues. So thanks so much for joining me, John. It's really great to have you on the show because, you know, you've been one of a number of MPs who's spoken openly about their experience of growing up with a parent with alcohol dependence or an alcohol problem. And yeah, I think that's a really powerful story to share. And you've done that really well and articulately in a number of different spaces. But could you tell me a bit about that experience and how you came to share it publicly, please?
Yeah, of course. So alcohol has played such a huge part of my life. And I can never remember not being aware of alcohol. I can never remember that alcohol not being a part of the backdrop to my childhood. Because my dad, as I've said many times now, had a drink problem. And I was aware going to a hospital when my dad was in hospital when I was about 5 or 6. At the time, I didn't quite understand why he was in hospital, but I found out when I was a teenager it was because of his drinking. And at them days, he was drinking a bottle of Canadian whiskey a day, Canadian Club whiskey. It was his favourite. And the doctor said to him, look, you've got to stop doing this. You're going to kill yourself. So he moved from Canadian Club whiskey to bottles of wine instead, bottles of white wine. And throughout my time growing up with him, they were divorced. I mean, drink wrecked the marriage as it wrecks a lot of marriages. My mum and dad were divorced. But the times I was with my dad, he would fill up the fridge with massive bottles of white wine from the corner shop, from the off-license, cheap white wine, these big bottles of German white wine. And the weekends with my dad, when I went to stay with him as a child, he was full of drink a lot of the time, and it was always there. And you know, you get through it because children can be more resilient than perhaps we think. I'm a father now. I think I obviously am so determined to protect my children. I obviously think of them as if my two girls are fragile, but I think sometimes you forget how resilient children can actually be, and you sort of grow up quite quickly in those circumstances. You end up looking after your dad. But I always remember that when I was older now, when I was about 30 or so, my dad had left the country. He went off to live on his own in Thailand, which I thought was bananas in itself. But he just did it just like that, just went. Sold everything he had, literally went and lived virtually on a beach in Thailand. Two years later, I got the phone call at 6 a.m. telling me he was dead and he was only 60. And he'd just been drinking every day in Thailand for these last 2 years of his life. And I remember the woman on the phone who gave me the news, and she wasn't trying to be insensitive, so I don't hold this against her. I think she was just trying to be sort of supportive. But anyway, she did say to me, you did know your dad was an alcoholic. And that was like a punch in the stomach. That was like a punch which had knocked me across the room. And not because it came as a surprise, of course it didn't, but to hear somebody say it, I think, as I say, it was like a punch across the room, or like a sort of cartoon character when you have a big, you know, a big weight dropped on their head, or a piano you see in a sort of Roadrunner cartoon or something. To hear someone articulate that out loud, because of course I always knew it. I've always knew that in my heart. And your point about language and research, I think, is so important, because you obviously focus on the stigma associated with that word, quite rightly. But I think there's something else about that word, in as much as a lot of people who have a drink problem do not identify with that word, will not identify with that word, because that for them conjures up something else in their minds, that perhaps conjures up somebody on a street corner drinking out of a brown paper bag or something. I remember as a teenager saying to my dad, "Dad, I think you're an alcoholic." And he would say, "No, I'm not. I'm not, because I can hold down a job. Alcoholics can't go to work." And he said, "When I'm at work, I don't drink." And he was right, actually. He had a very complex relationship with drink, because when the days that he went to work, he didn't actually drink. The problem was that the days when he wasn't in work, he was drinking constantly. And of course, when work was taken away, or he'd left work at 50, 58 and a half, he was just drinking every single day. But there was something about that word which meant my dad, who clearly, quite self-evidently, had a serious drink problem, just refused to accept that he was an alcoholic, which in turn, he refused to accept that he needed any help because of that word. So I think you are so right to focus on that word and talk about drink problem or alcohol problems, alcohol dependency as well, because I think a lot of people who quite clearly have problems refuse to accept that word and are doing themselves and their families immense damage as a consequence.
Mm. That's well, thanks again for sharing that. It's such a powerful story, and I think it's really complicated in the sense that, yeah, as you know, I generally advocate for alternative use of language to describe alcohol problems, because yeah, the stigma associated or embedded with that term, or the idea or the stereotype of alcoholism, is so heavy that it does prevent many people from perhaps, yeah, recognizing their drinking problem, because, you know, to adopt that label is to really become a target for stigma. You know, people, it's so embedded within negative stereotypes, as you describe, of, you know, rock bottom and not being able to function and so on. So it's self-protective in a way to not adopt that label. But then obviously there's the complicated side of Alcoholics Anonymous, because so many people do recover through that route where they take on that label and, you know, use that label almost as a way of not just making sense of their alcohol problem and, you know, joining community that can help them recover, but also as a kind of way of just saying, "I'm owning this problem and I'm going to face it head on." So it's really complicated. And alcohol problems are so complex and unique and individual that there's never going to be a one size fits all. But yeah, I think, you know, having people like you talk about your experience and us to talk about the language and the labels and the ideas and what they mean is our kind of way of unpicking that and trying to work through it. I mean, sometimes some people say we just need to destigmatize the term alcoholism or the label alcoholic. And, you know, I've thought a lot about that. My view is the evidence is once that term is so heavily stigma embedded, it's very hard to row back on that. But at the same time, I think, yeah, we just need lots of, the more conversations we can have, the better, including ones that look at and speak honestly about the pros and cons of different ideas or concepts or language in different contexts.
Mm. I mean, that's absolutely right. And of course, as you know, I do a lot of advocacy work for, and indeed have done fundraising London marathons for, NACOA, National Association for Children of Alcoholics, who do embrace that word. And I honestly don't know if this is because I do work in this space now, or if it is, or if there has been a degree of change in the last few years, but I do notice more people saying, I am a NACOA, I'm a child of an alcoholic, and self-identifying in that way. Look, I think it's not for me to sort of police the way people want to describe themselves. I think, and if there are people who are prepared to speak out and spare their own testimony, their own lived experience to help others, I think that is so precious. That is so important. But I do know that term, I think, was a barrier in my own relationship with my dad, in as much as he refused to identify himself with that term. And who knows? Maybe we could have made some progress if we could have explained it to him in different ways. I don't know. On the other hand, you know, he was also a very much a kind of, look, I was very lucky in as much as my dad's drinking never turned into violence, sexual violence, or anything like that. It was, you know, for me as a child, It was just there, and it's the constantness of, in what in many ways is the tediousness of it. You see, my dad was a great personality. He was good fun, and for his, you know, and for all of his sort of friends and that, he was great company. He's a great sense of c'est la vie, you know, and having a drink, having a great laugh. Yeah, fantastic. But then I was always the one who had to deal with it at the end. Mm. And it can be pretty, as I say, tedious, particularly when you're a teenager, having to put up with this constantly. But as I say, I was fortunate in as much as I didn't ever experience any violence or anything like that, which I know a lot of people face in these circumstances. And is, I think, is a real problem, or has been a problem in recent times, because, look, you know, I think we needed to lock down the country for COVID, but we know that when people are in enclosed spaces and there is alcohol and they can't leave the house, sadly, tragically, children and partners would have been exposed to some of the very darkest elements of alcohol abuse, sadly. And I think we have a problem in as much as, you know, not, I don't want to be party political on your podcast, but we do know, don't we, that specialist services for alcohol, specialist services for addiction, specialist service for domestic abuse and so on, they've been so cut back in these recent years. They've been so hacked away that we've taken away so much protection and help, which some of the most vulnerable would be able to turn to. And that is a real worry for me as a politician.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, someone who's kind of worked in public health and commissioning of alcohol services for a while, you know, it's obviously been really frustrating. You know, we had some great local alcohol services maybe 10, 15 years ago that just weren't able to survive those cuts. And, you know, we've got now a sector of a few big providers now who are drug and alcohol services, and you know, they're doing some good work, but it's still, you know, a product of lots of cuts meant that some really good local services have been lost, and alcohol specialist services as well, which basically don't exist anymore. So yeah, I couldn't agree more with you on that point. And then there's also the obvious policy levers that are available that, you know, aren't really being utilised. Obviously, Scotland has minimum price, and, you know, the debate continues on about the evidence, and it's obviously a fairly low price threshold of 50 pence a unit that was delayed for a long time by kind of legal challenges by sections of the alcohol industry. But we do know that pricing, availability and advertising influence consumption and, you know, indeed what the level of exposure children, young people and partners, etc. have. So I expect you agree as well that we need to do better in policy terms as well. But of course, you know, it's about kind of winning over the public as much as it is persuading certain MPs, I guess.
I mean, absolutely. So, you know, to answer your initial question, actually, why did I choose to speak out? Well, I was appointed to be the Shadow Secretary of State for Health. And I thought to myself, well, look, Shadow Health Secretaries, you know, quite rightly go on the news every night to complain about A&E targets and waiting lists and ambulance delays, and quite rightly, because all of those, everything is, well, it was terrible then. It's absolutely catastrophic now. but it was terrible then in 2016. But I thought also, I've got a platform now to speak out on these issues, which I really care about. And I hadn't really spoken out properly before, because I wanted to make a bigger argument about the health of the nation. And I wanted to make a bigger argument about people who are vulnerable, people who are left behind, who are neglected. And I do think we have an addiction crisis in the country. Through my personal experience, I obviously focused on alcohol, but this, you know, substance misuse, gambling as well. I wanted to talk about these issues. I wanted to talk about some of the failures in public policy, in as much as, you know, you know, some addiction issues are a consequence of mental health problems. But if you go to a mental health provider, they'll ask you to get clean, resolve your addiction issues before they can properly treat you. In turn, you'll go to an addiction service or say, well, this is a mental health problem. You need to go to a mental health provider. So you get bounced around the system quite a lot. But I also wanted to make that bigger argument about public health and about what we do as a society to improve health outcomes, because, you know, the NHS, you know, if you like, should in theory fix you at the end, or fix you when you're ill, fix you when you're broken. But we don't want people to be broken in the first place. It's that famous sort of Desmond Tutu quote, you can keep pulling people out the river, but eventually you've got to go upstream and find out why they're falling into the river in the first place. And you've got to do things. Your government can make, can intervene, change things to make big changes to attitudes. Look, when I first started in my working career 20 years ago, the year 2000, I left university and went to work in office jobs in the Labour Party. I was a researcher. Always been office-based policy research jobs. But it was not unusual in the year 2000 for people to be smoking at their desk in an office. I mean, you say that to people now and they look at you as if you're bananas. It would not be unusual to go perhaps to a conference and for there to be ashtrays on the tables in 20 years ago. The point I'm making, and if I was to go to a conference now, and I mean, I don't smoke, but if I did smoke, can you imagine how aghast people would be if I took out a cigarette and started smoking it on a conference platform? The point is 20 odd years ago, that was part of the norm. So you can change attitudes. Government and can intervene. And of course, the smoking ban was a big intervention the government made, which helped change attitudes. So governments can intervene and can change attitudes and change behaviours. Which is why I'm very interested in the research from the experiments around minimum unit pricing and so on. All of this takes governments to step up and intervene.
Yeah, I think I saw a statistic some years ago about how just 4% of, you know, healthcare spending was on prevention out of the whole budget. And yeah, there's so much more we could be doing, as you say, upstream. And yeah, I guess it's complicated because, of course, you know, there's policy levers as well. But then, you know, we also need to look more broadly at society. And, you know, I kind of feel like, yeah, so much of this kind of addiction crisis, as you say, is driven by this kind of rising tide of mental health issues in young people around uncertainty and climate change and economic insecurity. So I think you said, you know, you didn't want to be party political, but I think it's almost impossible not to. You know, we can't. Alcohol is a really important issue that we need to look at and focus in and try and understand in detail. But without disconnecting it from the broader context and environment that drives and shapes how people use and develop problems with alcohol as coping responses or because of cultural norms and the language, etc. So
absolutely.
Yeah, and just kind of going back to your point earlier briefly about you know, not policing people's language, I think that's another really tricky kind of or complex part of it, because yeah, certainly I don't want to be seen as a kind of word police or anything. And yeah, absolutely, people are going to use language or can self-identify, and that's not my place or anyone else's to tell them how they should or shouldn't self-identify. I guess I'd just say though that, again, you know, that happens in a context that, you know, perhaps the kind of received wisdom is this kind of often falsely dichotomized idea of alcohol problems, where you either have a problem and it's really severe and you lose your job or you don't. And I think sections maybe of society push that deliberately because it serves the purpose of protecting, you know, the majority's drinking as, in inverted commas, normal, and then others, the kind of outgroup, as the problem. And yeah, there's all kind of complex reasons for that. But yeah, I just wanted to sort of clarify as well. I agree that it's not about telling people how they describe themselves, but saying, you know, that there's implications from the way we frame and discuss and think about things. And yeah. And the other thing I was really thinking about as well that you mentioned right at the beginning was in terms of kind of resilience. And I guess also as children, you know, we have protective view of our parents, and then, well, there might be some dissonance about how we, you know, see our parents. And then in later life, you know, we look back and think, you know, of course, I saw that in a kind of strange way. But seeing your parent as having an alcohol problem as a child is a difficult thing to do, because that goes against how we're kind of, I think, primed or designed in many ways to, you know, trust and love and care about and care for our parents as well. That's kind of part of our innate desire. So it's only really kind of looking back that we might unpick things and see them a bit differently. But
no, you're absolutely right. And these things stay with children as well. They always ask themselves, they always go over these things and are trying to understand what, you know, whether they could have done something else. And obviously, you also feel guilt as well when you speak out. You wonder whether you're sort of being disrespectful to his legacy or memory. But I also know that when I speak out, I get a lot of messages of support. But one of the most important ones was when I was stopped by somebody. They said, oh, you're that MP, aren't you? And when you get stopped by people going, you're that MP, you think, oh, where's this going? Because anyway, they said to me, saw your speech in Parliament. It was going around Facebook and my son showed it to me. My 14-year-old son showed it to me. And because of that, I was able to have a conversation with my son about my drinking. So thank you for speaking out. And just that conversation, that one conversation, I think, makes doing what I was doing worthwhile.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure hundreds or thousands of others have happened as a result of what you've done, and some of your other colleagues as well have done very bravely and admirably as well. And yeah, I think, you know, as MPs, you are very much under the spotlight and in influential positions, and being able to talk about things that potentially might cause people to make assumptions or judgments, or, you know, view you in a less positive light, takes a lot of courage, and but also brings the issue out into the open more, and hopefully enables other people to feel more normalized talking about what are often tricky issues to do. And as you know, I'm a big fan of other people doing so. Adrian Charles, I think, had a really good impact. And we know that when his documentary came out, that lots of people, more people requested help and more apps were downloaded and so on. And I expect similar effects have happened from others who have recently shared their story. So yeah, as you know, like I'm just really grateful and supportive of anyone who talks about their experience, because yeah, we just need, you know, that to keep that conversation going. And hopefully that in turn will help reduce stigma and increase support for policies that also can help us be more preventative about alcohol as an issue.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's so important when people speak out. It does make a difference. I've seen that directly. And actually, by speaking out also, we eventually persuade the government. It was Jeremy Hunt, who was the health secretary at the time, was so moved and persuaded by the points we were making that he allocated a pot of money to support various charities who help children of children impacted by parental drinking. But sadly, that money is now dried up and is not being replaced, which is something I'm very disappointed and angry about. But at least for a few years, there was some extra support in place for the various charities who work in this space.
And if you don't mind me asking, how has your experience, do you think, kind of shaped your own relationship with alcohol? I mean, there's obviously kind of a bit of a reputation of a parliamentary drinking culture, and, you know, people kind of often say, well, it's a disgrace that there's subsidised bars in the House of Commons or whatever. But, yeah, do you have any sort of personal reflections about alcohol that you're...
Well, I mean, I do drink, but I'm also very happy not to drink. I can very happy to go weeks, if not months, not drinking. But I do drink, and although I'm always sort of conscious and thinking about, you know, how much I'm drinking when I do drink. The alcohol culture in politics, I mean, there is an alcohol culture. It's not as bad as it was years ago. I've seen it change considerably in 20 years. Since I started off as a researcher in politics to becoming an MP now, there's not as much drinking that goes on, I would say, although there is more scrutiny and awareness of the inappropriate and sometimes quite horrible behaviour of drunken MPs. We've seen various examples in recent times, haven't we, of MPs being alleged sexual assaults and things like that from... You know, we've seen that in the papers with one or two very dreadful cases in recent times. And I would assume that alcohol plays a part in some of that. But broadly speaking, though, I don't think MPs drink as much as what used to happen 20 odd years ago, because the hours are different in Parliament. But there are bars in Parliament. I never really know. This might sound a slightly naive point, and I might provoke a backlash by saying this. I never actually know whether the drinks are subsidised or not. I know people sort of say this, but I don't know whether it's that sort of, or maybe it's just not for, you know, they don't make a profit on what they sell. Maybe it's something like that. I don't know. But I suspect, though, it's a high adrenaline environment. And I suspect in any high adrenaline work environment, a lot of drinking goes on, whether they, regardless if they have a bar on their work in their workplace or not. I imagine most high adrenaline environments have a local pub, a local bar where perhaps too much drinking goes on. I don't think there's something particular to politics which is different to other very pressured work environments, I suspect.
Yeah, and I think, I've discussed with other guests before that, it's really important that we don't ignore the benefits of alcohol to people socially mainly. And, it's complex. We can say that moderate levels of alcohol, if we define that as within the guidelines of 14 units a week, are very unlikely to cause health problems, and that there is a place for moderate drinking, I think most people would say, where the benefits for the vast majority of those people would presumably outweigh the costs. So I do think, it's not useful for the case against alcohol harm if we fall into the arguments that we just the neo-temperance lobby, as if, we want to go back to prohibition or anything like that. That's not what we want. But it is a really complex and tricky question, to what extent should regulation, apply, or pricing or whatever. And, there's no fine line. There's lots of grey areas, as there is with trying to understand alcohol problems, etc. But perhaps we haven't quite got the balance right in terms of regulation and cultural permissiveness or attitudes towards it. But
no, I mean, absolutely right. And I think some of these issues are, there's obviously, an important lobby for alcohol. The Scotch whiskey industry is significant part of our economy in Scotland and is a significant part of our exports. We've got, for parts of the southwest, the traditional cider industries are an important part of their economy. And of course, politicians are always worried about appearing to be sort of killjoys. Every budget, a chancellor will get up and say, "I'm taking a penny off a pint." Well, not necessarily every budget, but when they do so, they love to say that. So, and there's always then follows the picture of them pulling a pint in a pub somewhere that appears in next day's tabloid newspapers. Mm. So, I think politicians are sometimes anxious, on these issues, and worried about intervening. So these are some of the challenges we always have to confront when we talk about the alcohol industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the economic case is pretty clear that the harms, the costs to society are outweighing the economic benefits, at least. But we don't reject that the benefits exist both kind of socially or individually, as well as there are economic benefits, but obviously a lot of costs as well. But I guess, my view is, in a way, actually, we need, it's like you mentioned earlier with the pandemic and the hidden harm from alcohol use behind closed doors. And even as you say, the sort of lunchtime or workplace drinking culture has improved a lot. But, what we've essentially seen over the last 20, 30 years or longer is a shift essentially where almost all drinking was done in on-trade premises, in pubs and so on, to where it's now basically the other way around, sort of 80%, I think, as much as all consumption is now off-trade. So I do think there is a sort of policy case or public health case even for saying, we want to remove the really, or kind of curb the really cheap off-sale supermarket, stack it high, sell it cheap culture, sort of partly drives home drinking, and try and move more drinking occasions back to safer, regulated spaces. But again, that's a kind of difficult and complex argument to make.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. And, then you get into sort of questions around, the big supermarkets and, what they can charge. And of course, there's another issue, which is a sort of, very topical issue at the moment, is this energy crisis means that pubs and restaurants are facing huge, huge catastrophic energy bills, with many of them, I'm sat here in Leicester where I live, many of them are asking themselves whether they can survive. You could see a wave of pub and restaurant closures, which is devastating for local jobs and livelihoods. But that, again, could drive even more alcohol consumption into the home.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know what the stats are at present, but, even pre-pandemic, I think pub closures were something like close to 30 a week, which fallen from a period where it was over 50 a week. So, we're still losing pubs and on-trade premises, and I'm sure the pandemic's probably accelerated that and embedded a kind of home drinking culture even more, or heavier patterns, as we know that pandemic people with pre-existing heavy alcohol use or alcohol-related problems, were the people that whose drinking really, really increased. So, yeah, I think we're going to be seeing the effects of that for years to come. And, yeah, hopefully we will start to see some more proactive policy changes to help kind of try and redress that, both in terms of, as you say, investment in services, as well as the upstream stuff around pricing, availability and marketing, and perhaps maybe trying to offer more support to potentially more regulated, safer on-trade spaces. Of course, not to say that all home drinking is inherently bad, but yeah, of course, we know that's where a lot of the very real harm, damage or heavy drinking is done. All right, John. Well, yeah, unless you've got any final reflections, well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and again for, you know, talking so openly about your experience and being a, you know, really valuable advocate for this really real issue of alcohol problems, and importantly, I think, you know, affected others that often doesn't get enough attention or enough space in terms of the spillover effects, how other people's drinking affects other people. I think that is really something that needs more active attention as well. And
well, no, thank you for having me. And it's been a really fascinating discussion, and it's such an important issue. And I'm not in the shadow health brief now. I'm in the shadow work and pensions brief, and I'm very completely preoccupied at the moment with the rising cost of living and the impoverishment of our fellow citizens that we're seeing. And I know that when poverty and deprivation increases, people increasingly turn to alcohol and substance use, to self-medicate, to relieve the pressures that they're under. And that in itself leads to social problems for the individuals, health outcomes, family breakdown, sadly, violence and so on, as we've discussed. So this is a really worrying time, but one that I will continue to speak about in public. So thank you for having me.
Thanks again, John. Thanks so much. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Alcohol Problem Podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram @AlcoholPodcast, so please feel free to follow us or get in touch there.